The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payden reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Reuters, The Economist, and the Religion News Service. First of all, from Reuters, published on January 8, the article, Pope Calls for Universal Ban on Surrogate Parenting, calls it deplorable. Pope Francis called on January 8 for a global ban on parenting via surrogacy, calling the practice deplorable and a grave violation of the dignity of the woman and the child. Francis's remarks are largely likely to antagonize pro-LGBTQ groups, since surrogacy is often used by gay or lesbian partners who want to have children, and follow his landmark decision to allow priests to bless same-sex couples. I deem deplorable the practice of so-called surrogate motherhood, which represents a grave violation of the dignity of the woman and the child, based on the exploitation of situations of the mother's material needs, he said. Consequently, I express my hope for an effort by the international community to prohibit this practice universally. Francis, 87, made his comments in a 45-minute address to Vatican-accredited diplomats, which is sometimes called his State of the World speech. There are few statistics on the number of babies born through surrogacy. Due to ethical concerns, the practice is illegal in many countries around the world, as well as in some U.S. states. Critics of the practice warn of the potential for a poverty bias against women who become surrogate mothers due to financial need. But interest continues to grow as more women opt to postpone pregnancy until later in life, when fertility wanes, and as more same-sex couples look for ways to start families when they can't conceive on their own. In Italy, the country that surrounds the Vatican, surrogacy is illegal, and Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni's right-wing coalition ruling is pushing through Parliament a law that would extend the existing ban to punish couples who go abroad to carry out the procedure. Francis, who leads the world's more than 1.35 billion Catholics, also reaffirmed the Vatican's condemnation of gender theory, which suggests that gender is more complex and fluid than the binary categories of male and female, and depends on more than visible sex characteristics. He called the theory extremely dangerous, since it cancels differences in its claims to make everyone equal. Now a piece from The Economist published on January 6, entitled Cancel Culture Kampf. What do an Indian poet, an Australian political scientist, an Irish folk troupe, a British architect, a Bangladeshi photographer, an American historian of the Holocaust, a Chilean composer, an Israeli-Austrian playwright, a Dutch footballer, a German-Nigerian journalist, a Palestinian novelist, a South African artist, and Bernie Sanders, the American senator, have in common? All of them, and many others too, have in the past 3 months found themselves abruptly canceled in Germany. The reasons cited for pulling the plug on their shows, grants, contracts, awards, or meetings with public officials have varied slightly, yet all hang on a single fear, that these disinvited people, quite a few of whom happen to be Jewish, might have said something that someone might see as anti-Semitic. German ultra-squeamishness about anti-Semitism did not begin on October 7, the day the Hamas gunmen from Gaza launched a murderous rampage that left 1,200 Israelis dead. There is a context, beginning, obviously, with the Nazi regime's murder of 6 million European Jews. One answer to that horror by subsequent generations of Germans has been to embrace the creation of Israel as a happy ending to their own national nightmare. Over time, says Eyal Wiseman, the British-Israeli leader of forensic architecture, a research group that has probed anti-Semitic attacks in Germany, as well as Israeli human rights violations, Germans have come to see any challenge to this redemption myth as something akin to committing a sin. This evolution started decades ago, with Germany's decision to offer war reparations not just to Holocaust survivors, but also to the new Jewish state. In the late 1960s, the darker chapters in German history began to be explored with sharper objectivity. This long process of coping with the past grew to underpin a new, self-effacing German national identity. Angela Merkel, the chancellor from 2005 to 2021, cemented the sense of a special responsibility to Israel by stressing that its security is a part of Germany's own reason of state. In 2019, ironically, at the instigation of the Alternative for Germany, a party widely shunned as fascist, German legislators adopted a motion that equated calls to boycott Israel with anti-Semitism. This official conflation, identifying opposition to Israeli policy with hostility to Jews in general, spread more widely with the appointment of government anti-Semitism commissioners. Organizations that rely on state funding, which in Germany means a very large proportion, have found themselves increasingly scrutinized over suspicion that they might cross this bureaucracy's vaguely defined lines. The fear of budget cuts or public ostracism, the underlying cause of the rash of cancellations cited above, is not misplaced, as Oyun, a cultural center in Berlin, discovered in November. The city abruptly severed funding for the venue after it hosted a pro-peace Jewish NGO that one culture commissioner thought might encourage hidden forms of anti-Semitism. The horror of Gaza, where Israeli forces have now killed more than 18 times as many people as Hamas terrorists killed on October 7, has exposed the awkwardness of Germany's one-sided embrace of Israel, but also placed Germany's Jews in a quandary. Some fear that official overprotectiveness could itself provoke an anti-Jewish backlash. By contrast, Weiland Hoban, a Frankfurt-based composer and Jewish activist, suggests that being told by the German establishment how to be Jews could itself be called anti-Semitic. But perhaps the advice delivered at a Berlin seminar in December by Alon Lee Green, an Israeli activist, is easier for Germans to understand. If you really want to act as a good friend to Israel, he said, criticism is fine. When a friend is drunk, you don't give them another drink. You take them home and put them to bed. Now an article from the Religion News Service published on January 10, written by Bob Smetana. The SBC will sell insurance, retirement, to women pastors, if they aren't Southern Baptists. Southern Baptists do not believe that women can be pastors or that churches should baptize infants. But that won't stop them from doing business with churches that disagree. The Global Methodist Church, a relatively new denomination made up mostly of former United Methodists, announced this week that Dallas-based Guidestone Financial Resources will administer its retirement, health insurance, and ancillary benefit programs for the denomination starting in July. Guidestone, which provides insurance and retirement plans to pastors, is an entity of the Southern Baptist Convention, which last summer passed a constitutional amendment that bars member churches from having women in any pastoral role. That amendment first proposed by Mike Law, an SBC pastor from Virginia, must be confirmed in 2024 to take effect. Several churches were expelled from the SBC in 2023 for having women pastors, including Saddleback Church in California, one of the nation's largest congregations, and Fern Creek Baptist Church in Louisville, Kentucky. The SBC's statement of faith has previously also limited the role of pastor to men, but there had been disagreement over whether that limit applied only to the role of senior pastor or to any pastor on a church staff. The Global Methodist Church, by contrast, affirms women pastors. As part of its decision to have Guidestone administer its benefits programs, the Global Methodist Church has communicated to Guidestone that it is unequivocally committed to the ordination and deployment of women in any and all leadership positions in the Global Methodist Church and its regional conferences and local churches. Keith Boyette, Transitional Correctional Officer for the Global Methodist Church, told RNS. When it was founded in 2022, leaders of the Global Methodist Church had named Wesbeth, which manages benefits for the United Methodist Church, to administer denominational benefits. But they have since decided to make a change. Denominational rules require GMC churches to work with the church's plan administrator, in this case, Guidestone. Julie Capozzi, Managing Director for Communications at Wesbeth, said the agency could still provide services to GMC churches that wanted them. "We are positioned to serve an individual GMC church for their employee retirement services if they choose to remain with us," she said. The new denomination currently has 4,290 congregations and 4,400 clergy, most of which were formerly United Methodist. More than 7,600 congregations have left the United Methodist Church since 2019, including more than 5,000 in 2023. In a schism mainly over LGBTQ affirmation and ordination. Boyette said he did not have statistics on how many of the GMC's clergy are women. The denomination's Transitional Leadership Council includes two women pastors, according to the GMC website. Guidestone has worked with non-Southern Baptist churches since 2004. After getting permission from the denomination's annual meeting to do so. Guidestone President Hans Dilbeck Jr. told RNS in an email statement, "Those denominations may disagree with the SBC over pastoral roles, but agree on other core beliefs," he said. "While we may disagree on some beliefs and practice, we share far more in common with those brothers and sisters than we have differences, and are able to serve them effectively in their benefit needs," he said. All have affirmed that they share historic biblical convictions regarding Scripture, Christology, gospel proclamation, and marriage. Dilbeck said the constitutional amendment applies to SBC churches and not to churches that Guidestone serves outside the SBC. "We trust Southern Baptists to make a final decision and respect the will of the convention," Dilbeck told RNS. Guidestone will only work with SBC churches that are in good standing with the denomination or one of its state conventions. That would rule out churches that have been expelled from the denomination, even if they previously did business with Guidestone. Churches that are no longer part of the SBC but remain part of a state convention could still work with Guidestone, a spokesperson told RNS. Churches that are no longer part of the SBC could also apply to part of the same program as the Global Methodist Church. Law told RNS that the Bible, not the amendment he backs, bars women from the pastorate. However, he did not see the amendment affecting Guidestone's work. God limits the pastorate to men in 1 Timothy chapter 3, verses 1 through 7, and Titus chapter 1, verses 5 through 9. "Not an amendment," said Law, pastor of Arlington Baptist Church in Arlington, Virginia. The proposed constitutional amendment addresses which churches may send messengers to the SBC's annual meeting. It does not address who Guidestone serves. That decision is left to the trustees of Guidestone. Boyette said the GMC is confident in its choice of Guidestone. "The Global Methodist Church has been assured by the leadership of Guidestone that decisions made by the Southern Baptist Convention on issues such as the ordination of women or women serving in any clergy role do not and will not impact the services that Guidestone provides to the Global Methodist Church." Now, an article published by the Religion News Service on January 10 and written by Catherine Post. "Wheaton College restricts employees' ability to state preferred pronouns." Wheaton College, a flagship evangelical school in Wheaton, Illinois, recently updated its student and employee handbooks to restrict employees' ability to designate personal pronouns and to elaborate on the school's position on trans, non-binary students and faculty. The college does not permit the statement of preferred personal pronouns by employees when conducting college business, when on a platform where they are publicly identified as college employees, and or when using the college brand in print or digital media, except when employees are required to submit such pronouns when registering for a conference or for membership in a professional organization, new language in the student handbook says. Updates to the handbook, which were approved in October and shared with employees in December and with students in January, clarify that the college does not endorse the statement of preferred pronouns by employees or students of Wheaton. While the handbook exclusively recognizes the pronouns he, him, his, and she, her, hers as reflective of the created biological binary, it does not appear to explicitly prohibit students from using or stating preferred pronouns, including they, them pronouns. In an email to RNS, a spokesperson for the college confirmed that Wheaton had updated its policy on gender and sexuality in both the student and employee handbooks, the latter of which is not publicly available. Although it had been more than a decade since the policy was last updated, substantive changes to the policy were minimal, the spokesperson wrote. "The biblical principles and theological convictions on gender and sexuality articulated in the college's statement of faith and community covenant have not changed." Previous versions of the student handbook indicate, and the new language affirms, that Wheaton College considers the decision to undergo a medical transition or to engage in other persistent actions or behaviors at variance with one's birth sex to violate the school's theological commitments. However, the new language goes on to say the college would consider hiring or enrolling people who have transitioned if it does not violate the college's religious convictions. For instance, if the transition took place before that person became a Christian, or to address a unique medical condition. The handbook does not define what falls within its definition of a medical transition from a person's birth sex. Both the previous and current versions of the student handbook make clear that the college believes God created sex to occur in the context of marriage between a man and a woman, and prohibit same-sex sexual behavior, including marriages, civil unions, or dating. The handbook also has and continues to clarify that Wheaton hopes to be a loving community that respects and cares for all its members, including those who experience incongruity between birth sex and gender identity. On January 8, a new Instagram account called Wheaton Watchdog, which says it was created by Wheaton alumni, posted a screenshot of the updated language in the student handbook. Even as a private institution, the updated rules and guidelines fall under the umbrella of medical discrimination, on top of being incredibly hateful and transphobic, the photo caption says. There have always been queer people at Wheaton, and the school continues to ensure we will never feel welcome or safe on campus. Now, an article published by the Religion News Service on January 9, written by Simranjeet Singh, the makers of the unconventional superhero film American Sikh. Once the idea for Sikh Captain America, a turbaned, bearded version of the Marvel comic hero, was born, it took more than a year for him to appear on the streets of his native New York City. The creation of Vishajit Singh, a writer and illustrator in Harlem, and the photographer Fiona Aboud, who was working on a photo project, Sikhs an American Portrait, the character is a social experiment about what it means to be American and to be Sikh in America. Now it is also a short animated film by Singh and Ryan Westra that recently premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival. The film tells the true story of Singh, 52, who, besides inventing SikhTunes.com in the face of anti-Sikh bigotry after 9/11, is a performance artist and diversity speaker. After a lifetime of facing prejudice, self-doubt, and violence, his animated self, as in life, finally finds acceptance in a superhero costume. He first drew Captain America in a turban and beard in 2011, but it took almost a year after Aboud discovered the character to convince Singh to step out and seek Captain America on the streets, where his mission is to tackle bias and intolerance, powered by his humor, turban, beard, and storytelling prowess. I had the opportunity to speak with Singh and Westra to discuss the what, why, and how of American Sikh. This interview has been adapted for clarity and concision. How did this film come about? In 2014, as my very last student project in film school, I happened to be assigned to do a live-action documentary about Vishajit's work as Sikh Captain America. While shooting that project, Red, White, and Beard, I was so impressed by Vishajit's ability to inspire people to open up about their stereotypes and biases in a positive way. Yet, as we wrapped the shoot, I watched a stranger on the street call Vishajit Osama bin Laden moments after changing out of his superhero costume. It was a shocking juxtaposition to witness, and it made Vishajit's work even more impactful to me. Ever since then, I have been interested in working with him again on a more in-depth and ambitious project. In 2019, I reached out with the idea of doing, an animated short about his life and more broadly, the struggles that the Sikh community has gone through. What do you hope the film will accomplish? In a recent interview, our incredible executive producer, Vikas Khanna, had a beautiful answer to this question. He said, "I believe that the answer to hate cannot be hate. With the difficult times we are facing right now around the world, I think now, more than ever, is a perfect time for us to gain greater understanding, empathy, and compassion for those around us." I've spent years traveling around the nation, visiting schools, companies, and government agencies to share my story and create a space for conversation about identity, bias, vulnerability, and transformative power of art. I hope in amplifying this message via an animated film, we can encourage others to do the same with their story. I hope this film opens doors for the most underrepresented and misrepresented stories to be shared across American media, cultural, and entertainment landscape. Unfortunately, especially since 9/11, turbans and beards have been villainized and portrayed as un-American in the media. Seek Captain America challenges those stereotypes in a lighthearted, creative, and familiar way. Our hope is that this image sticks with people, and they are able to walk away with a greater empathy for all Americans who, as Vishajit says, look a little different. What's been most gratifying so far now that audiences have seen the movie? Hearing feedback from people from varying backgrounds about connections they find with my story. It's extremely exciting to be working with Vishajit on such a historic project. Never has any American Sikh story reached this level of prominence. With so little representation in the media, it's exciting that we have the privilege of introducing Vishajit's beautiful religion and work to so many people for the first time. How does this film depict Sikh characters differently than other media? Much of the Sikh media I've seen has been created by Sikhs for Sikhs. This film is meant for people who maybe have had little to no experience with Sikhs. It's created with a national audience in mind and tells a story that is relatable to many Americans, not just Sikhs. What were some of the biggest challenges to pulling this story together? With animation being extremely expensive, we had a lot of back and forth, narrowing down the few key chapters of my life to tell the most compelling and concise story. There were 30 different cuts of the film that we user tested on Ryan's friends and family who knew nothing about me or Sikhism at all. This helped us pick the most impactful moments. But there are a few poignant moments and experiences that did not make it into the final version of the film that I typically include in my life story. We have run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. I hope you'll listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payden, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.